Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
I think it is fair to say that the death of Martin Luther was not entirely expected. Of course, he was an old man, old by the standards of his day and age. He was hardly in the best of health, even by the standards of his day and age. But I don't think people expected him to die while off solving some sort of a, what kind of came down to an economic or political conflict between two parties. He's dead. And then what happens to the Reformation? Of course, Luther's death came as no unexpected thing to him. About the last decade of his life, he's thinking he's going to die every year. And of course, he was a man who contemplated death as a Christian ought to. We're going to be talking about Luther's final year before his death. Pastor Matt Harrison joins us as we broadcast from the symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on this Tuesday afternoon. Pastor Matt Harrison is president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and he's going to be making a presentation here at the symposia titled Old, Cold, Lame, and One-Eyed Luther's Last Year. Matt, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd. Good to see you, as always.
It was, in some ways, a sudden death, but Luther had been thinking about dying for quite some time, hadn't he?
Quite a long time. He'd been making statements about his death very often in the year before. He dies in February on the 18th at about 3 a.m., 1546, and well before. He'd made a lot of statements, studied death, wrote on how to, he wrote on the sort of art, the ars moriendi, the art of dying, already in 1519, a sermon on how to die. And so he had thought about the themes of death a lot. He had had the Edict of Worms after confessing before the world, Charles V in 1520-21. He's got this edict over his head. He's Vogelfrei. That is, somebody could kill him, and there would be no consequences. He's a heretic. He could be done away with. And he lives with this sort of death sentence for his whole life, so he thinks about death a lot. But toward the end, of course, his health is getting bad. His health had been bad from the 1530s. Many people think it's because of the austere life and self-punishment that he undertook as a very observant and rigorous Augustinian monk. He was part of the particularly rigorous order of the Augustinian friars. There's a whole list in Breck's biography, third volume, whole page of his ailments, loud ringing in his ears. He had, from 1543 on, he had a hole in his leg, on his lower leg, where blood was drained. It was believed, doctors believe, you could drain blood from people and balance the humors somehow. He had headaches. He had any number of other health problems that you could expect from a person that age relative to his diet. Katie would tell him, look, you've got to change your diet. And he said, I'll eat what I want and God will kill me when he wants. He finished his Genesis lectures. He'd been lecturing on Genesis for 10, 15 years. He finished his Genesis lectures in the fall of 45 on November the 17th. He said, that is the dear Genesis brothers. And his students had written all these notes down over many years and collected them together. Thank God they did. They did it faithfully. About a week before that, he celebrated his birthday, his 63rd birthday, and he said to the friends gathered, I will not live to see Easter.
He was an old man. 63 seems young today, but in his day, that was old age, wasn't it?
Yeah, pretty old. I mean, you hear people living into their 70s and maybe even late 70s on occasion in his era, but most of the time, these Lutheran scholars, they die in their 50s.
Let's talk about the world that Luther left behind that last year. Kind of, what was the Turk was banging at the door of Western Europe. The Pope was doing all sorts of things. Talk about some of those things. What was going on in politics?
It's one of the most extraordinary years in all of history. 1545.
Really?
Yeah. Luther faced Charles V, emperor. Charles was born in 1500. So Luther faces him at Worms the first time. The Diet of Worms, the Reichstag of Worms, where these German nations and emerging nation states, all in the German Holy Roman Empire, would come together and try to resolve issues. Well, ever since 1521, they'd been trying to resolve the Luther problem. And through the entire period of Charles V's reign, from the time he is crowned to he's there the entire period of Luther for 25 years. He meets the descendants of Luther. The princes are protecting Luther, still alive in Wittenberg. So it's a burning issue. But in 1530, it's a huge issue when the Augsburg Confession is confessed. Charles V wants to get rid of this division in the empire. He is a simple man of faith in many regards. He's faithful to the Catholic Church. He believes the church should be the arbiter of religious truth. However, he has a problem. Suleiman the Magnificent, who rules the entire period, even for a longer period than, and Suleiman lives to be in his 70s. Suleiman the Magnificent is the Ottoman Emperor. And Suleiman is head of this empire that was, of course, growing. Constantinople falls to the Turk in like 1325. And you have these series of rulers ruling from now Istanbul. And yearly, every year, they would make raids. Suleiman and his troops would make raids up into Hungary. And at the time of the Augsburg Confession, they got as far as, they were getting as far as Vienna. They had taken at various times Buda, the two cities, Buda and Pest. So the emperor could not come down hard on the Lutherans. You know why? He needed their money and he needed their troops. That was one dynamic. You had other dynamics going on. Strangely enough, the Christian king of France, Francis I, was ruling in this period of time, ends up dying just a year after Luther. Christian king of France had joined in alliance with the Ottomans.
Really?
Decades before, over against the Christian emperor.
So this was a mess.
It was a complete mess for the whole period. And not only that, you throw Henry VIII in, and Henry VIII is fighting with Francis I. Ferdinand is down in Austria, and he's the king of the Romans. He's the brother of Charles V, and he's crying out, I need help with these Turks, for Pete's sake. So it was just this crazy, crazy world dynamic that, and if you, there's a great book by Warwick, recently published, The Four Princes, and it deals with the lives of Henry VIII, Francis I, Charles, and Suleiman the Magnificent. Charles lives the longest. He ends up abdicating because he loses the small called war. He wins the small called war, but ends up losing in the long run. He abdicates, and the other guys, within a year or so after Luther's death, Henry VIII is dead, who had an incomparable rule, and Francis I is dead, and nobody follows any of these leaders who has any kind of their authority or influence for years and years.
So, you know, we've talked in the last several months in the press about how 2016 was one of these years in this world. We had people dying. We had strange elections. Sounds like 1545 was one of those years.
It's in one Western of those Europe. Years. The Germans go to Worms, and they're calling out. They're saying, look, here's what we're going to hold to. We're going to hold to the previous Reichstags, which have said we're going to have dialogue of religious matters, we're going to have peace, and we're going to have protections for the emperor while we dialogue. And if we have those things, we'll give you troops and money to fight the Turk. Well, now, Charles has been working his tail off for years. He gets the Treaty of Crepy, fixed in the fall of 44, and all of a sudden he's not fighting France anymore, and France is still fighting Henry VIII. Henry VIII is usually allied with the emperor. They get that worked out in the course of the year. The emperor goes to Worms, and all of a sudden rumors are coming out. What's going on with the Turk? The Turk's attacking. No, we're hearing stories. We're hearing a rumor that the Turks have signed a treaty with the French. Now we're hearing a rumor the Turks have signed a treaty with the emperor. Uh-oh. What does that mean? That changes everything. There were spies going back and forth. The Counts of Mansfeld, who Luther was working on the settlement of their religious and their practical difficulties and animus, they had sent a spy down to Trent. So the Council of Trent is Paul III is Pope. He doesn't want a council. He doesn't want reform. None of the popes wanted reform. I mean, these guys were derelicts. Even Hubert Yea Dean says of the Pope at the beginning of the Reformation, Leo X, he says, here's a guy who did not have 1 ounce of concern, pastoral concern in his entire being. He liked fine art and women. Now you have Paul III, who's a Farnese, and he's a known homosexual. He's got a young, like a teenager, whom he, I think, elevated as cardinal. He's made a cardinal by the age of 25. He has 5 illegitimate children. And if you want to know the kind of decadence that reigned in the period, he once sent his son, Pier Luigi Farnese, who was a completely decadent individual, a profligate son. He gives him 3 orders. He was on an embassy to Marseille for the French. And his father, Paul III, says, first, do the best you can not to commit sodomy with anybody in the French court. And I always forget what the other 2 were.
It's easy to forget after that.
Ironically, though, Paul III ends up, because all of a sudden the emperor moves on the treaty with the Suleiman the Magnificent. So the doors open for him, for his grand plan to come together against the Lutherans. And so he's acting all in the spring and summer. He's got gout real bad. The Diet of Worms opens up in April or so, March or so. He doesn't show up. He's up in the Netherlands. Meanwhile, he's up there enforcing some hard-nosed articles that were written by the Louvain theologians. Luther wrote against them. And he's implementing them. Persecution breaks out. There was a Spanish reformer up there, Encinas, who was jailed. And all of a sudden, this guy miraculously gets out of jail. It's an amazing story. And he right away travels to Wittenberg and tells them what's going on. As you read I've got the correspondence of Luther's last year right here. Every other letter has, you know, as for what's new, what are you hearing? Here's the latest rumor. Here's where the emperor is. The emperor was holed up with gout in the Netherlands, and he said, I am not able to sign a truce with it. I've not been able to be at peace with my gout. And he finally gets better and ends up going to Worms. At that time, Farnese had come forward from the south. A lot of people don't realize. You know, Luther wrote this horrendously insulting stuff against the Pope in 1545, against the papacy at Rome established by the devil. And people are just aghast by this kind of stuff. And it is ghastly. Luther talks about excrees and excretals of the Pope. And it's not, shall we say, family reading. But here's what you got to realize. The Pope sends his nephew, Cardinal Farnese, north to meet with the emperor, and he promises him 12,000 troops and a couple, 2,000-3,000 cavalrymen, and he promises them. He also says, if you quash the Lutherans, we will let you take 500,000 ducats, probably millions and millions of dollars, of church property in Spain and secularize it and keep the money. Now, see, people don't realize the Pope Luther was dealing with had an army. He had a cavalry. He even had a navy. And at the beginning of 40, at the beginning of the year. In fact, it was the 1st of January, 1545. The French king made a decree, the Arrêté de Maginot. It was an act which said that the Waldensians, this Protestant group that had been in the French Alps for years, hidden away in the valleys, could be attacked. And so the French king indeed attacks them in April, kills thousands of them. The Pope gives the perpetrator, the general who perpetrates the actual act, he gives them papal knighthood. So we're not dealing with John Paul II here.
That's for sure. Let's take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what brings Luther to Eisleben, ironically, the town of his birth, where he would eventually die. Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is our guest. I'm talking with regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb about a new book by one of his former professors. Which one, Ken?
The late Dr. Kurt Marquardt, and the book is The Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People.
You edited this book.
Yeah, the unpublished manuscript was among Marquardt's papers, and it is vintage Marquardt, lively, engaging, centering in the Christ who saves, with an apologetics chapter at the end.
You can find out more about Saving Truth, Doctrine for Lay People at lutheracademy.com.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on beautiful children's Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Confessional Lutherans, we've got your back. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Pacifica, California. Messiah Lutheran, Danville, California. Faith Lutheran, Capistrano Beach, California. Grace Lutheran, San Mateo, California. Our Savior Lutheran, Grand Rapids, Michigan. St. Paul Lutheran, Hamel, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Brookfield, Illinois. Grace Lutheran, Racine, Wisconsin. St. John's Lutheran, Mayville, Wisconsin. Prince of Peace Lutheran, Crestwood, Missouri. Faith Lutheran, Plano, Texas. St. Paul Lutheran, Austin, Texas. University Hills Lutheran, Denver, Colorado, St. John Lutheran, Topeka, Kansas, Peace Lutheran, Alma, Michigan, Zion Lutheran, Imperial, Nebraska, and Trinity Lutheran, St. Charles, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, Pastor Matt Harrison, President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is our guest. We're talking about Martin Luther's final year. You wanted to say something about Luther's longtime colleague, the lay theologian Philip Melanchthon, in connection with that last year and death.
It's really a conundrum. You know, Philip is writing all the great scholars in Europe, and he's writing Bullinger, the great Reform scholar in Zurich. He's Calvin. We got correspondence between Calvin. And Philip was progressively moving away from Luther's doctrine of the Lord's Supper. He already in 1528 or 26 had written that he did not believe the consecration affected the real presence. And then Calvin wrote him later on, 44 or so, and said, I like your doctrine. It doesn't have all Luther's words like corporal and physical and all those kind of things. Well, Luther decides he's going to write a blast on the Zwinglians because they had ticked him off about something. The descendants of Zwingli, and Zwingli was dead in 1531, but Bullinger and Company, they had written something that got his ire. And so he writes a book in 1544 in the fall, and Philip is just sure that he's going to be blasted by Luther in this book. And Philip is writing to his friends, I'm going to have to leave town. And this book comes out, and Philip, you know, thumbs through it, and to his great relief, he's not in the book. But what was happening is it's actually true. Ratzeburger, Luther's doctor, wrote about this, but it's actually true. Graduates of Wittenberg were going out while Luther was still teaching. They were going out and they were teaching a Calvinizing doctrine of the Lord's Supper. And so this crisis is averted. That's 44. 45, in April, I found this amazing letter, never translated, in the Corpus Reformatorum, the great 19th century collection, especially of letters dealing with Melanchthon. And here's a letter from Luther's prince, Johann Friedrich. He writes to Chancellor Bruch, his man in Wittenberg, the guy who read the Augsburg Confession in front of everybody in German in Augsburg 15 years earlier. And he says, it has come to my attention that our Dr. Martin wants to write a book against the Sacramentarians. This pleases us very much. But it has also come to our attention that he intends to mention Philip by name. And we know if he does this, he is going to go for the jugular. This would be a very bad thing for our university. Would you please, in a way that you know best to do, Dr. Brook, please approach our dear Dr. Luther and implore him to go to Philip one-on-one, and if he has a difficulty with Philip's teaching on the Lord's Supper, to talk to him directly. And then, I'm sure Philip is an excellent man, then Philip will change his what needs to be changed. And if he doesn't, assure Dr. Luther that we will take the next steps as necessary. Not 2 days later, I found another letter where Luther writes to Amsdorf, I think his friend. He says, I've decided not to write against the Sacramentarians. And I think Bruch, what he did, I think he got the letter. He went right to Luther, and I think he did exactly what the Prince Elector told him to do. And there's no evidence of it, but I think Luther talked to Philip, and Philip backed off. And you find the whole rest of the year, you never find a break. Philip travels with Luther for his last journey, second but one, to Eisleben to resolve the problem that he was trying to resolve up there. Luther writes to Philip. He's concerned about Philip's health. The next colloquy was already at Regensburg, and the emperor was acting like he wanted to talk religion, you know, while he's gearing up for war. Luther says to John Frederick, he says, look, Philip is worth more to us sick here than he is dead there. Please don't send him. But it's a conundrum, because after Luther died, then things really went to pot.
What brought Luther down to the home of his birthplace, to Eisleben, where he would die unexpectedly?
There were three or four counts in this little duchy called Mansfeld. It's called Mansfeld because a man could walk around it in a single day. It had been divided up since it's like farmers, you know, the farm gets smaller and smaller as the sons inherit pieces of it. Several of them lived in a castle above Luther's childhood home in Mansfeld, the town of Mansfeld. And they hated each other. They were fighting over mining rights, taxation of smelters. They were fighting over market taxation of a place called Newtown. And Jonas, Luther's friend, called it a pig's business. Luther took off, preached his last sermon in Wittenberg on a Sunday. It was, I think, January 23rd. Melanchthon prayed for him as he left town. Melanchthon didn't go this time. Luther got to Bitterfeld that evening. The next day they came into Halle. His buddy Jonas was the main pastor, the bishop at Halle. And that had been a very difficult move for everybody because the Roman Catholics had been very strong there. By this time, 5,000 people a week were jamming into St. Mary's Church in Halle to hear Jonas's catechetical sermons. The next day, they took off out of town, got about a mile out of the center of town to the river Saale, and they had to stop because it was impossible to get a boat across. It was jammed with ice. There had been a huge freeze and then a quick thaw, and there was flooding and ice everywhere. And Luther said, wouldn't the devil love to swallow us up right here? Luther was there with his three sons, Hans, Martin, and Paul. They were ages 19 or so to 13 with him on this trip. Jonas went with him. At that point, Luther wrote a letter to his wife. He had to turn back to Halle. Luther writes a letter to his wife and saying, that old Anabaptist River Sally, she wanted to baptize me again, but I wouldn't let her. And he ended up preaching in Halle. At one point, he spilled a cup while he was distributing the sacrament, and he actually knelt down and licked up the contents that had fallen on the floor of the chancel. The congregation burst out in tears at the old man doing this. He finally left when the water was better. He got in the boat, got across. He was taken. He was feeling very sickly. He was looking sick. He was feeling sickly. As they got to the border of the Duchy of Mansfeld, he was met by 113 horsemen from the counts. He had tried to walk alongside the carriage. His heart was bothering him. He had pain in his arm. Already a month or two before, in the middle of the night in Wittenberg, they had heard a big thud. And sure enough, it was Luther who had fallen during the night, probably his heart stopping. They would rub him with warm towels, and that seemed to relieve the situation. So he makes it to town. He blames, in a letter, he blames the Jews. They lived in a town nearby, and he blamed the wind blowing over the Jews there. And you just can't defend Luther's views on Judaism. They aren't blood and race like the Nazis, but the Nazis used them. But it's also the case, as Gritsch points out in the last book he wrote, Against His Better Judgment, the whole Christian world shared these views on Judaism at the time. That's no excuse for them, but it's really inexcusable. On the other hand, he writes these letters to his wife, which are fantastic. Dear Madam Brewmeister, Madam Saumeister, my lord at Wittenberg. She brewed beer, and in some significant quantities. She took care of a farm that Luther had at Zilsdorf, and they had other properties in Wittenberg besides the property that was given to them by the elector. Luther went to work on the problem, and the lawyers drove him crazy. The counts weren't talking to each other. The only thing they were doing was talking through their lawyers. Man, have I been in meetings like that in my life in the church and otherwise. They're the worst circumstances you ever want to get into. Luther complained loudly about the lawyers, and Albrecht, the oldest, I think, of the counts, the brothers, was an irascible man. They worked for weeks. Luther was there for 3 weeks. He preached three times. He preached the final time in St. Andrew's Church, and toward the end of the sermon, he said, I feel weak, and I must quit. And he got down, and he was taken. He used to be taken across the street from St. Andrew's for the death house. That was the great Prussian monument. The Prussian king who debilitated Lutheranism horribly, nevertheless put monuments to Luther up all over the place. Well, turns out Luther didn't die there. He died down the street. As the records now show, that house has been demolished. But I'm sure Luther's much happier that he died down the street, since his monument is right outside the front window where that house would have been. He, on the night of February 17th, did not feel well at all. He was in the day bed for a time. Jonas was with him, and also Michael Caelius, who also wrote an account of his death, preached a sermon on it. Luther rested for a while. He got up and prayed by the window. It was his custom to pray at about 8 p.m. at night, standing by the window with the window open, looking up into the sky, and he would pray aloud. So people who were with him on these occasions often heard him praying and what he was praying for and praying fervently for. And then he came and joined them for a nightcap. He usually had a glass of wine or something. And then he lay down again on the leather bed. It was a day bed of some sort. A little bit later, he woke and he looked around at Jonas and these guys that were with him and says, "What are we doing up?" And they said, "We're here to make sure you're okay, Dr. Luther." He got up by himself. As he walked across the threshold into the bedroom proper, he said, "Into your hands, O Lord, I commend my spirit." And he said it in Latin. He said all the Bible verses in those last days as he would. He learned the Bible from Latin. "Into your hands I commend myself. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have eternal life." He repeated these several times. He went to bed. They held candles in front of his face to check to see if he was still alive. His extremities started to grow cold. I think it was probably after he awoke. I think they asked him, Jonas asked him about 1 a.m., "Dr. Luther, will you die in the faith which you have confessed before the world?" And he said, "Yeah," his last word. And then his extremities began growing cold. They had tried to give him some remedies previously. They tried narwhal, which is called unicorn in German, but some scrapings from a narwhal horn. They didn't have any. They had medicines, but not anything like we have today, of course. And about 3 o'clock, breathed his last in a shallow last breath and gave up the ghost. And that was the end of what is surely one of the greatest lives in history. I was talking to Dr. Weinrich yesterday. I was speaking about Luther's last year, and I said that, you know, many even recent studies have shown that Luther's the top 10, say, of most significant people in Western history. Dr. Weinrich said he had a secular, non-Christian prof when he was at University of Oklahoma, and the guy said, "Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Luther. These are the greatest men in all of history." Luther's influence on so many things was just absolutely, I mean, rights of conscience, even though he was inconsistent. Rights of conscience, the right to stand, the right to believe something against your prince. Without Luther standing and confessing, Peace of Augsburg would never happen in 1555, which gave individual emerging nation states the right to believe differently than the emperor. In 100 years, less than 100 years, the next step of having the right to believe differently than your own temporal king individually believed came. And I would say even, you know, Magdeburg fighting against the emperor after Luther's death, cutting out a space to confess over against your political leaders because of conscience, the free conscience relative to God. That's Luther, plus all the public education, the education of women, the reform of university, the miraculous events in music and advances in science and everything else. Luther, it wasn't the Lutherans who were dogging Copernicus or dogging the new discoveries on denying a heliocentric universe. So that was the death of one of the greatest men of all history.
It's often said here with about a minute, Matt, that, and I don't know how apocryphal this is, that after his death, there was just found a scrap of paper in a pocket where he had written in Latin and German, "We are all beggars, this is true." First of all, is that true? And what does that say, if true, about Luther's thoughts there near the end of his day?
It's absolutely true. It was found by Johann Aurifaber, his famulus, kind of a secretary, lived with Luther. He was the last one of several of these guys who would assist Luther throughout his life. after Luther had died, he found the scrap of paper, and on it it said, "You cannot understand agriculture unless you've, you know, read Virgil's Bucolics and worked in the fields for 25 years. You can't understand the New Testament unless you've ruled the church with the apostles for 100 years." And then it closes with this statement, "Wir sind Bettler, hoch ist verum." We are beggars, this is true. Hermann Zasse called this the great Luther's Vermächtnis an Christenheit, Luther's great legacy to Christianity. That is, over against Rome, over against the gross Pelagianism, synergism, the nonsense, the buying yourself out of purgatory with money or good works or everything else, that the ridiculousness of all this, Luther's great legacy is that we are beggars. We have nothing in and of ourselves. Nothing. We bring nothing. Simply to thy cross I cling. And that is his fundamental genius. It's grace. All grace.
Pastor Matt Harrison is president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He's going to be making a presentation at the symposia here at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, titled "Old, Cold, Lame, and One-Eyed Luther's Last Year."
That's a quote from him, by the way.
Oh.
Describing himself.
Matt, thank you so much for being our guest.
As always, it's a wonderful pleasure, and God bless you and all your wonderful listeners out there. You're terrific folks. Keep the faith. Keep smiling. The Lord's in his heavens. Amen.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we will talk with Pastor David Peterson about Jesus cleansing a leper. We'll discuss the Women's March on Washington with Joy Pullman of The Federalist. And we'll talk about sexual temptation with Dr. Ben Mays. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening. Good night from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.